Hello, this is episode number 10 of Mrs. Endicott's Splendid Adventure by Rhys Bowen. Your reader is Chris Knapp. Episode 10. We need to hide the chickens and the goats, Tommy said. Those Huns will take them without a second thought. So they set to work constructing a new chicken coop behind an arbor of wisteria and staked out the goats during the day outside the property on a section of hillside where they could not be seen from any footpath. Just as long as the chickens don't make too much noise, Tommy said. Thank God the last rooster died and we never got a new one from the farmer. And the motor car, Clive added. We should hide the motor car so that they don't take it. But if we need it to get away? Ellie asked. There's nowhere to go, is there? Tommy said. We're sitting ducks here and no way to get petrol. Ellie thought that Nico could probably find some for them, but she did realize that a British motor car squatted on any road would be too obvious. They went down to the garage. Ellie drove out the Bentley, and together they managed to maneuver it into the space behind the garage and shed, covering with a tarpaulin and letting the bougainvillea spill over it. Then Clive and Tommy placed old rubbish bins and pieces of trash around it. The result was satisfying. Ellie wrote to Abbot Gerard, warning him that Germans were now in occupation. He wrote back that he had assurances that the abbey would be safe and allowed to continue, but warned her to be very careful. It didn't seem that the Germans were going to make life difficult, apart from establishing a curfew at 10 p.m. This upset the fishermen. We often go out at night or in the very early morning, they said, appealing to the officer in charge. That's when the best fishing is. So if you'd like a good fish supper, then you have to let us fish. You will now fish during the daytime, when your boats can be inspected, the officer told them. We cannot risk any smuggling of goods. Ellie's thoughts went instantly to Nico. She hadn't seen much of him in recent weeks. If he had come to the villa, it must have been in the middle of the night. Then one night, Ellie had just gotten into bed when there was a rattle of something at her window. She opened it, looked out, and saw a dark shape of a man below. "It's me, Nico," he called up to her in a whisper. "I'll come down." Ellie hurriedly put on her robe and came down the stairs. She opened the front door, and he slipped inside, glancing around before he closed it behind him. "I have to ask a favor," Nico said. He was breathing heavily, as if he had run up the stairs. "Yes?" she looked at him uncertainly. "I had to make a dash for your little harbor," he said. "Luckily, my speedboat can outrun them, but I can't get back into the town. There are Germans everywhere," he said, "guarding the harbor. Can I perhaps stay here tonight?" "Of course," she said. He smiled then, and she realized how harried he had looked. "Come into my kitchen," she said. "I have cognac." He nodded. "That's good. I am really cold." She led him through and poured him a glass from the decanter. He took a sip, then gave a sigh of satisfaction. "Thank you," he said, "and thank you for taking me in." Ellie nodded, not sure what to say. "I may need to make this request more often," he said. "Would that be all right? That I could spend the night here when I need to?" Ellie hesitated. "Look, Nico," she said, "I have other people in the house I can't put in harm's way. I have to know if you are doing something illegal, something that could get us all into trouble." He stared at her. "Yes," he said, "I suppose I am, in a way, and you are right. I should not put you in harm's way. I'll stay here now, but..." She took a deep breath. "I've wanted to ask this question for ages. Nico, are you a smuggler? Are you bringing in black market goods?" She was surprised that he smiled then. "I have been known at times to import an occasional bottle of wine or spirit without paying the taxes," he said. "But the answer is no. But it is dangerous. I will be taking messages. I may be bringing items up to store in the shed, items that could be useful, like guns." Suddenly she understood. "You are helping the resistance?" "The less you know, the better," he said. "If you see me at night crossing the garden, then pull the blinds and look away. then if you are questioned, you can genuinely say that you knew nothing. Nico, she reached out and touched his arm. Please be careful. You sound concerned, he said. I'm touched. I thought you despised me. Of course I'm concerned, she said, and I never despised you. To start with, you did. I saw your expression when you caught me crossing the garden that night, he laughed. I thought you were up to no good, hiding stolen goods in someone else's shed. He put hands on both her shoulders. My dear Ellie, I am going to tell you something that is strictly between us, and only because I might not make it out of this war alive. But I want you to know the truth about me. I was born in this house, in the room where you are now sleeping. She stared at him, trying to digest this. She saw the twinkle in his eyes. You're joking, she said. He shook his head. Not this time. My mother was Jeanette Hertou. The opera singer? Your mother was the opera singer? She fought not to raise her voice. But that's ridiculous. I've met your mother, a sweet little old lady called Madame Barbeau. My adoptive mother, he said. When Jeanette became pregnant, Marcel, the rich duke, decided he wouldn't allow a baby. His wife was the jealous sort and would make a fuss in Paris society. He insisted Jeanette find a good home for it, like a puppy, if she still wanted to be his mistress. Of course, she liked the perks of the job, so to speak, so she obeyed. She found a childless couple in the village, and they agreed to say it was the child of a cousin who had died in childbirth. I saw your photograph, Ellie blurted out. It was in Jeanette's drawer, hidden among her underclothes. A beautiful baby. I often wondered. It's more than I've ever seen, he said. I don't remember her at all. You never met your mother? He gave a little sigh. Apparently she did come to see me a few times when I was very young, but then the relationship with my father came to an end, and she never returned to the villa. She just walked away, abandoned you? She preferred money and fame, I suppose, and she wasn't the motherly type. Oh, she did provide for me financially, paid for me to go to a good school and then to the Sorbonne, but she never wanted to meet me. But then she died and left you this villa? He nodded. The villa and a good amount of money. That's why I don't need to work hard, which is nice. Why didn't you take over the villa? Two reasons. Because the truth would come out and it would upset my mother, the woman who raised me, and second, because Jeanette never wanted me in her lifetime. I bore a grudge against her and wanted nothing to do with her. Let the villa crumble into dust. She examined his face. So you're really the son of a duke, she said. That's why there was always something different about you. Did you never try to contact him? Nico shook his head. Once, he said, I was in Paris at the Sorbonne, and I had the absurd notion that I should present myself to my true father. I was sure he would acknowledge me, welcome me with open arms, and afford me all the privileges of a duke's son. I found his house in the 8th arrondissement near the Seine, and I was getting up courage to approach the front door when it opened and he came out. He stalked past me as if I were a speck of dust on the pavement, shouted some command to his chauffeur, got in, and drove away. That look of absolute arrogance. I decided he would not want to know me. I'm sorry, Nico. It must have been very hard for you. On the contrary, I grew up in a loving home. My father taught me everything about fishing. I went out with him on the boat, much better than being raised by servants or dragged around by an opera singer. Ellie stood up, realizing how late it was. I'll make up a bed for you. No need. I'll sleep on a sofa. I'm easy to please. He smiled then. But if I do have to come again, I'll have the spare room ready, she said, and I'll leave the front door unlocked. He stood up too. So what will your husband say, he asked, his eyes teasing hers. Will he beat you for inviting a strange man into your house? My husband is currently asleep in his room with someone other than me, she said. I should go back to bed. He put his hands on her shoulders. You asked me earlier why I didn't make you an offer, he said. You accepted Tommy's because you knew he would make no demands of you. I should have wanted to make demands. For a moment she thought he was going to kiss her. Then he released her and went through the sitting room, leaving her feelings a little shaken. Chapter 37. Ellie sat on the side of her bed, staring out into the blackness of the garden, trying to digest all that she had learned and felt. That Nico was Jeanette's son was almost too much to believe, and yet it explained his behavior, and she had sensed he wasn't lying to her. That he was now working with the resistance was a worry, both on his behalf and on hers. If he stayed at this house, he would put them in danger too, and yet she couldn't say no if he needed help. And there was the other matter, the fact that he desired her, that she had definitely felt something for him. "I'm too old for such nonsense," she told herself. But there had been a shiver of excitement when he looked at her that way and told her he wanted her. After so many years of not being desired, of being taken for granted, of occasional passionless sex after Lionel had drunk a good deal of wine with dinner, it felt strangely exciting to realize that she might not, after all, be too old. When Ellie got up in the morning, Nico was gone. Over breakfast, she told Tommy and Clive about the nighttime visit and warned them that he might have to spend the night on occasion if he couldn't get back into the village. "So he's working with the resistance, is he?" Tommy said. "I must talk to him about that." "Oh, I don't think he'd like to talk about that," Ellie said hastily. "The less we know, the better. That's what he said." "No, I'd like to find out how we can help," Tommy said. "I feel that I'd like to be doing something useful, and Clive can offer his forger's talents." "Oh, no, please don't get involved," Ellie said. "These are brutal men. Look how many resistant workers have been executed in the north." "But we only have a chance of defeating those brutes if we all help out," Tommy said. "Don't worry. I can see myself blowing up any railway lines or shooting generals, but I'm sure there's a small job I could do." Apparently he had a conversation with Nico, and the small job turned out to be a radio positioned under the floorboards of Tommy's bedroom. Nico came up to instruct him how to use it, and he started leaving messages he had received in the big stone urn on the terrace for Nico to pick up at night. "Italy has occupied Corsica," he said at dinner one night. "That is good news. It gives us more chance of an escape route, if anyone needs it. The Italian guards won't be as strict, and the coastline is so mountainous and rocky that they can't put guards everywhere." Ellie felt a shiver of fear. Tommy was enjoying being part of the action, but now for the first time they were in the midst of danger, and the war had become real. Rations were cut severely, and they heard that local farms had their livestock taken, but still the chickens and goats survived at Villa Gloriosa. Ellie and Mavis took down the extra eggs and milk to be shared with those who needed them most. It seems the Germans had not yet discovered the villa. Perhaps they thought those steep steps merely led up to hiking trails to the Calanques. After the Germans had been in evidence for a few weeks, Ellie came home to find they had a visitor. The Viscount was in their sitting room, sipping a cup of herb tea. He looked less like his sophisticated and polished self than usual. In fact, he looked positively unkempt, as if he had dressed in a hurry. "Thank God you have returned safely," he said as Ellie walked in. "None of us is safe any longer. They came to my villa today, German officers, horrible, rude men. They pushed my servants out of the way, looked around the house, and told me to get out, as they would now be occupying it, and keeping my servants to look after them." "How awful, Roland. What did you say?" "I asked where I was supposed to go, and they said there was a pension in the village that would probably have room for me, if I had no relatives nearby. They stood there while I packed a couple of suitcases into my motor car. Luckily, they didn't requisition that. I got out quickly before they could change their minds. So I came here. I couldn't think where else to go." "Of course you can stay here," Ellie said. She turned to the other men, "if that's all right with you." "The more the merrier," Tommy said. "But don't expect the Ritz. We live very simply." "Don't we all these days?" Roland said. "Do you know there is no coffee to be had? And those ruffians will now get their hands on my wine cellar? I muttered to my butler that he should close it and hide the key, but I bet they'll force it open. Ellie went upstairs and made up the bed in the last of the bedrooms. She was tempted to offer her own room to Roland and to take the room that was clearly designated for a servant, but she had become comfortable in that room with no wish to move, and beside, it was where Nico knew to find her if he ever needed to come in the middle of the night. He had not stayed at the villa again, but she had seen him cross the garden and knew that he was coming and going at night. She told Tommy to mention nothing of this to Roland. She feared he would give in all too quickly to Nazi interrogation. She wondered about herself. Of course she would not betray Nico, but what if the Gestapo came, or the Abwehr? So far it had only been regular soldiers who stayed in the village. But if she were ever taken for questioning, could she hold out if they tortured her? I know nothing, she told herself. I would genuinely have nothing to tell them. They'd have to believe that. That Nico, one of the fishermen said when she was down in the village and casually asked after him, he's finally decided to work for a living. He goes out in his boat almost every day now, makes a good catch, too. Ellie wondered if there was a double meaning in those words. Did the man know he was always running supplies for the resistance as well as catching fish? It appeared the Germans didn't, so far, nor had they yet discovered the villa. The officers held loud parties at Roland's chateau. The sound of their late-night singing and laughter drifted from over the hill. Roland was proving to be not the easiest of guests. Tommy and Clive, usually so easygoing, were clearly finding him a strain. "Do you know he took 2 eggs this morning?" Clive said. 2 eggs! And he put all that sugar in his coffee. Doesn't he know we are on rations?" He rolled his eyes. "And yesterday he asked Tommy to polish his shoes." "And did Tommy do it?" Clive gave a little grin. "Tommy said there were no servants in this house, and anything he wanted done he'd have to do for himself. He went away in a huff, but he did later come down to ask for the shoe polish." It was going to be a big adjustment for Roland, Ellie thought. He probably never had to do a thing for himself his whole life. He was lucky to be with 3 such patient people. After a few admonitions, he seemed to realize that they were being kind to him because he started to offer to help set the table, do the weeding. However, he declined at being asked to collect the eggs. "Horrible birds, chickens, absolutely murderous eyes. They'd peck you to death if they could." A month went by with nothing terrible happening. At the villa, they were still surviving quite well with enough eggs, cheese, vegetables, plus the occasional fish that could be brought from the dockside. Christmas was approaching, but there was no sense of excitement or anticipation in the village. The boulangerie was now barely given enough flour to make small loaves, 1 each per family. There will be no Bûche de Noël, no special pâtisseries, no holiday at all, Madame Blanchet said. And one of those cursed Germans had the nerve to ask me why I do not bake pain au chocolat. I told him we had not seen chocolate for 2 years now. If he'd like to produce some for me, along with the necessary butter, I will most certainly bake him a pain au chocolat. Ellie came out of the shop with her small loaf and had started toward the steps when she heard a scream. Bruno's mother was running towards her, her hands waving in panic. "You must help me, Madame," she screamed. "My boy, they've taken my boy." "The Germans have taken Bruno? Why?" "The officers saw him, asked him why he wasn't in a factory, and then realized he was not as other men. So they came in a big black lorry and took him away. They said there is no food for those who are not useful to society. And nobody did anything to help me. They let it happen. They just watched and let him be taken. Where can those devils have taken him?" "I really don't know," Ellie said. She felt sick. She had heard that within Germany they had removed those with disabilities, sending them to the notorious labor camps, or perhaps to their deaths. "He won't be able to cope without me," Bruno's mother said, clutching at Ellie's sleeve. "You know what he's like, how easily he gets frightened, and then he starts talking gibberish." "I wish I could do something for you," Ellie said. Have you spoken to Father André, to Monsieur Danton? They could perhaps inquire officially to see where he might have been taken. Tears were streaming down the woman's face. She shook her head fiercely, causing tears to fly out. What good are they? They believe we should not make a fuss, and thus keep the village safe. But it's my son, my poor Bruno. I'll do what I can, Ellie said, although she had no idea what this might be. She thought she might have a word with Father André, just in case the word of a priest might help. And she was on her way to the church when she saw Nico. She ran over to him, grabbing his arm. You have to help, she said breathlessly. They've taken Bruno. He looked down at her with concern. That poor boy. I feared this might happen. But I'm afraid it's too late to do anything. If they've already taken him, there is little we can do. We can stop them, Ellie said. You could stop them. You must be able to send a message to somebody, someone who can help. He was frowning. I'll come up with you and try to contact someone on the radio. It depends how long ago it was and where they are taking him. He put an arm around her shoulder. Come on, then, let's hurry. Did you bring your motor car? Of course not. There's no petrol, she said. I always use the steps. He didn't say any more, but together they climbed the steps, pausing, panting at the top, before going into the house. Clive opened his mouth to say something when he saw Nico, but Ellie shot him a warning look and shook her head as Nico ran up the stairs. A little later, he came down again. They will try to intercept the lorry before it reaches the train station, assuming he is to be deported to a camp or even to Germany, he said. But they are not hopeful. At least we tried, Ellie said. That's the main thing. That poor woman, she dotes on that boy. Nico looked at her with concern. I fear it is getting worse, he said. The Germans are suffering defeats. They fear the Allies will come up through Italy. They are already reprisals, so for God's sakes, stay up here, out of the way. Ellie walked with him out the front door. Listen, he said, we should have a sign if you need me. He paused, looking around. The property can't be seen from the village, which is lucky for you, but useless for me. He walked around to the terrace, overlooking the sea. But from my boat, or even from the end of the harbor, I could see these palm trees. If you erected a washing line, maybe between the trees, hang out your laundry regularly on it. But if you need me, hang out something. He paused, thinking, something blue, the color of France, eh? And I'll come right away. Something blue, she agreed. I made up a room for you, she said, but you haven't needed to stay the night. He shook his head. I didn't want to disturb you. I have managed to slip down into the village without the sentry seeing me. She realized that he did not want to involve her, to let her run any risk. She reached out to touch his sleeve. Nico, don't take chances, she said. He looked at her tenderly now. I have to take plenty of chances. I'm afraid, but I want to involve you as little as possible. He put his hand gently against her cheek. I wish things were different, he said. I wish I could protect you better. I'm fine up here, really, she said. It's you I worry about. If they catch you carrying weapons or even messages, they'll shoot you. He patted her cheek now. Luckily, I know this coast better than they do. There are plenty of little coves where I can hide out if I spot an enemy ship. And my speedboat can outrun most of them. He paused, thinking. I want to ask a favor of you. Go on. Ellie wasn't sure what was coming next. My mother, if anything happens to me, will you take care of her? Take her in, look after her, I'm all she has. Of course. You promise? I promise. But let's not think about such possibilities. I want you to stay safe. So do I, actually, he smiled. Then his lips brushed her forehead and he hurried off. It was the next day that Tommy received a message. Resistance fighters had indeed intercepted the lorry in Marseille. They had created a roadblock and opened the back door for the prisoners to escape. Most ran away, but Bruno just stood there, unable to decide what to do next. The Germans shot him. Ellie had to give this news to his mother and let the woman cry on her shoulder. My Bruno, she kept saying, my little boy, all I had in the world. Ellie felt a profound sense of failure, even though she had done all she could. They had done all they could. Sometimes the odds were just too great. Chapter 38. A funeral was held for Bruno, which the whole village of Saint-Benet attended. Everyone wept. Even Ellie, raised to show no emotion in public, sobbed. That such a sweet and gentle soul could have been taken so brutally seemed the ultimate inhumanity. Bruno's mother sat with a stunned look on her face, as if she still could not believe that her son was gone. "Don't worry, Madame, we'll take care of you," Mavis said to her. "Everyone in Saint-Benet, we all loved your son." As she walked back up the steps, Ellie realized how much she was going to miss him. He had become part of her life, appearing in the mornings with a big smile on his face and bringing the loaf of bread in better times, still nodding and smiling when she'd given him a task to do. "I can do that, Madame, don't you worry," he'd say, and set to work right away. "Maybe a swift death was better than one of those camps we're hearing about," Tommy said as he walked beside her. "For him, that would be the ultimate horror." Ellie tried to agree. "I keep thinking that this is just the beginning. Who will be next? Which person I love will be taken from me?" Christmas came and went with a midnight mass in a packed church. There was no Christmas feast at Henri's bar, and the people who filed out of church after mass wished each other a simple Joyeux Noël, then went silently on their way home. Tommy and Clive went out of the way to make the house look festive with draped greenery, a pine sapling as a Christmas tree, and cut-out paper decorations. Mavis and Louis came to join them for a Christmas lunch. For the celebration, they killed one of the hens that had stopped laying. Tommy, sentimental as usual, said a eulogy over it before putting it in the pan, and served it with roast potatoes, parsnips, and cabbage, followed by stewed apples and goat milk cream. They accompanied it with one of the last bottles of good wine. Roland toasted them to the magnificent chefs and the dear people who have made me so welcome, he said. You are my dearest friends. Ellie realized this was the wine talking, but was glad that he no longer seemed discontent and surly and had accepted his lot. If only we were at my chateau, I could have showered you with gifts, he went on, but here I have nothing except the clothes I stand up in. I am a pauper, an outcast, homeless, and he started to weep. What a treat to have chicken, Mavis said to Ellie, as they washed up after the meal. We have been living on turnips and beans mostly, unless Louise traps a rabbit. Things have been hard for Louise, you know. Those bloody Germans come and take his tools, bring things to be mended, and then never pay. I can tell you I'm half tempted to hit one of them over the head with a big shovel, she laughed. But it looks like you're doing all right up here. So far, you know, you're welcome to share any of our produce. You don't come often enough. It's all right. You've got four mouths to feed now, Mavis said. She glanced back into the sitting room where the four men were now drinking the latest excuse for coffee. Who would have thought it when we left England that we'd both be living with strange men? Your Lionel would have a fit. So would my Reggie, God rest his poor soul. Ellie had to smile. Not my choice of strange men, as you put it, but you're obviously happy with yours. Mavis nodded. He's a good bloke, kind, and not a bad kisser either. Ellie hoped to see Nico, at least to wish him a Joyeux Noël, but he wasn't at church, and she had no idea where he was or what he was doing. She found it hard not to worry, and at night she lay there worrying about her two sons. She had no idea where Richard's regiment was now, no idea if Colin was now an airman, if he was even still alive, and she had no way of finding out. At the Christmas Mass, she had prayed for both of them to the Virgin Mary, as Mavis had suggested, but with so much death and destruction, it was hard to believe that her one small prayer would make any difference or that any God would single out her sons to keep safe. The new year came with no celebrations, except for those German officers who had clearly found a way to access the wine cellar at Roland's chateau, judging by their raucous songs. Then in the middle of January, Tommy came downstairs with a grim look on his face. "They have started rounding up French Jews," he said, "in Paris now, but I'm sure it will include the rest of the country soon enough, taking them on trains into Germany." "We should let the Adamses know," she said. "You'd better tell them," Tommy said. "She despises us." So Ellie went down to the village. It was a cold and stormy day. Rain swept in off the sea, making the steps slippery, and the wind snatched at her breath. She held her scarf tightly around her head. At least the weather had kept people off the street. There was no sign of German sentries guarding the port. As she slipped into the pension, she knew why. The sound of animated German conversation came from the parlor, and a pall of cigarette smoke drifted into the lobby. From the kitchen came the delicious smell of real coffee brewing. Ellie stood for a moment looking around for Mrs. Adams. Then she rang the bell on the counter. Mrs. Adams appeared, but one of the Germans poked his head around the parlor door. "Hello, my dear," Ellie said in warmest tones and in English. "I haven't seen you in ages, and I miss our little chats. How have you been keeping?" Mrs. Adams looked at her strangely, but then caught on. "Not so bad," she said. "Yourself? Why don't you come into the kitchen and have a cup of tea?" She turned back to the German soldier who was observing them. "An old friend from our days in England," she said to him in French. Ellie followed her through the dining room and then into the kitchen. An old-fashioned stove gave a comforting warmth. There seemed to be a big pot of some kind of stew cooking on the stove. "Now then, what's up?" Mrs. Adams asked Ellie. Ellie lowered her voice. "They are rounding up Jews farther north, taking them away by train to camps. I thought Mr. Adams should know. He may want to try and escape before it's too late." Mrs. Adams' expression did not change. "Oh, don't worry about us, dearie," she said. "I think we're quite safe here. Nobody knows or cares that he's Jewish. He doesn't wear the star, so how would those Germans ever find out? Besides, we're getting along quite nicely with them. They bring the occasional coffee, a bit of meat. I think they like the way we treat them here, and they're quite content." "But if men come in from the outside, Gestapo?" Mrs. Adams shook her head with a patronizing smile. "If it's anyone would know or care about Saint-Benet. No, dearie, they want the big prizes, Marseille and Toulon. That's where they'll go looking." She paused. "Besides, where would he escape to? If they are checking papers, he'd not get 2 yards on a train. And I can't see him hiking over the mountains into Switzerland." She gave a little chuckle. "But it was kind of you to think of us. How did you hear about this anyway?" There was something in the tone of her voice that made Ellie wary. She suspected that Mrs. Adams wouldn't hesitate to turn herself and Tommy into the Germans if it got her an extra ration of something. "Oh, we can sometimes pick up the BBC on our radio," she said. "Being so high up, we get a good signal. Of course, it's still crackling and going in and out, but I'm sure that's what we heard." "You'd better not let those Germans know you're listening to the BBC," Mrs. Adams said. "Of course not," Ellie said. "But it's good to be informed, isn't it? Make plans just in case the worst happens." "I'd rather not know personally," Mrs. Adams said. "They pay good money to stay here. I treat them well, and will ride out this stupid war until it's over." There was nothing more to say. As Ellie walked through the lobby, one of the Germans stuck his head out again. "Hey, Frau." "Madame, come and keep us company," he called in bad French. "We're lonely boys, far from home." "We'd be very happy if you went home to your loved ones," Ellie said, "but I must go back to my husband. He wouldn't like me chatting with soldiers." As she glanced into the parlor, she noticed a girl sitting on the knee of one of the soldiers and was shocked to see it was Madame Blanchette's daughter. The younger one her mother had described as flighty. Giselle Blanchette caught her eye and gave a defiant stare back before she puffed on a cigarette and blew out smoke. Should she warn Madame Blanchette, she wondered? Then she realized that the girl still lived at home. Her mother surely knew, but perhaps she also benefited from the occasional gift of coffee or sugar. Ellie bade a polite goodbye to Mrs. Adams, then went back up the steps as always, a little shaken at any encounter with the German soldiers. They could be genial now, but rumors indicated that they wouldn't think twice about shooing someone who annoyed them in any way, or grabbing any woman they wanted. Thank heavens I look middle-aged and not at all desirable, she thought. The storms continued, the wind rattling shutters, moaning through the roof and hurling rain at the windows. The palm trees swayed and bent until Ellie thought they had to snap. The chickens huddled miserably in their coop and wouldn't lay. The goats were fretful in their pen. Ellie had just gone to milk them one morning and was returning when she heard someone hammering on the gate. She went to open it, and Mr. Adams half fell into the garden. "Mr. Adams, what is it?" She noticed then that he was carrying a small bag with him. His expression was of terror. "There's a German lorry in the village, and they're going house to house looking at papers," he said. "I don't know what to do. They'll take me away, won't they? My ID card gives my race." "Come in before you get soaked," Ellie said. "Then we'll think." "I don't want to put you in any danger," he said. "Don't be silly. Nobody checks up here." She went ahead of him into the house, put the milk on the kitchen table, and told him to sit down. She gave him a cup of mint tea. "We have to get you away," she said, "but I'm not sure how. Just lie low here for now." Then she went out to the clothesline, and in spite of the rain and wind, she hung a blue shirt on it. She didn't think it was likely that Nico would notice it on a day like this, but if he came through the garden at night, he would see it hanging there. The day passed. Tommy tried contacting the resistance operator on the radio, but without success. Ellie made up a bed on a sofa for Mr. Adams. Then as she was getting ready for bed herself, filling a hot water bottle, there was a tap at the front door, and Nico stood there, the rain running off his oilskin. "What's wrong?" he asked, shaking off the worst of the drips before he stepped inside. "Oh, you came. Thank God," Ellie said. She led him inside and pointed to Mr. Adams. The Nazis were in the village, checking identity cards. They'd see he was Jewish. Nico sighed. "Yes, they've already started taking Jews from Marseille. We have to get him away. But where? How?" "Corsica is now in Italian hands," he said. "If we can get him that far, he shouldn't be in too much danger. And we can work out what to do next." "Corsica? You don't have a boat that can go that far, especially not in this weather." "True," he said, "but I could take him out to the island. That abbot is a good fellow. I'm sure he wouldn't mind hiding Mr. Adams until we could work on our next step." "Yes, that's a good idea," Ellie said. "Nobody would notice an extra monk, would they?" Nico smiled. "Right," he said. "Have him get ready. I'll take him down to the speedboat." "Now? In the dark, in this weather?" "More chance of making it in the dark and in this weather," he said. "The German Navy won't bother to patrol as much when they think everyone stays home." A spasm of worry crossed her face. "But Nico, your little boat can't handle this rough sea, surely." Again he grinned. "We'll have to see, won't we? Wait until the storm dies down. He'll be safe enough here," Ellie said. Nico shook his head. "I don't want the Germans to find Adams here," he said. "They shoot people for harboring Jews. The sooner we get him away, the better. Don't worry. The worst thing that can happen is that he'll be seasick." They went through into the sitting room where Mr. Adams was getting ready for bed. He listened in silence, nodded, then put his shoes on again. "If it must be done this way, it must," he said. "Better than a train trip to Germany, anyway." Ellie followed them to the front door. "Take care, won't you?" she said. "Good luck, both of you." Then she watched them cross the terrace and disappear down the steps. The wind was making too much noise to hear the speedboat start up. She sat up for several hours, hoping that Nico would report back, then hoping he'd decide to stay on the island until the storm died down. At last, she fell into a restless sleep. When she woke, the first streaks of a red dawn were in the eastern sky. She put on her dressing gown and went downstairs. She half hoped she'd find Nico asleep on her sofa, but there was no sign of him. Chapter 39. Ellie dressed and went down to the village. hoping to use the excuse of a fresh baguette for breakfast to find out if Nico had made it safely back. His fishing boat lay at its usual moorings. There was no sign of the speedboat. If he had returned, he would have left it docked below the villa, she told herself. But then he would have to come up through the garden and surely given her some sign that he was safely back. She debated whether she should go to his house, but if he hadn't returned, she didn't want to worry his mother. So she lingered in the town buying a newspaper, or what passed for a newspaper these days, passing the time of day with those she met, before going back up the steps, glancing around first to make sure she was not noticed. The day seemed to go on forever. On several occasions she went out on the terrace, and once went down the narrow steps in the cliff to the little dock. It was empty. Fear overtook worry. She had heard the sort of things Germans did to those once they captured, especially if they were with the resistance. She hadn't realized until this moment how very fond she had become of Nico, and of course of the abbot too. If the Germans had followed Nico's boat to the island, found Mr. Adams, and taken both Nico and the abbot away, it was too awful to think about. "Don't worry," Tommy said, putting a comforting hand on her shoulders. "That bloke lives a charmed life. He'll turn up, I'm sure." They ate dinner. Ellie went to bed and was just closing the shutters when she heard the tap at the front door. She rushed down. Nico was standing there. "You made it. You're safe." She flung herself into his arms. He embraced her tightly, and they stood there for a moment, her cheek against his rough jumper. "You didn't have to worry," he said at last. "It was simplicity itself. We made it to the island, a little choppy, I have to agree. Mr. Adams had to keep bailing, or we would have filled with water." He laughed at the memory. "He was scared silly, I can tell you, but we found the abbot." He agreed this was a good plan, gave Mr. Adams a habit to wear, and all was well. "I'm so glad," she heaved a big sigh of relief. "So he can stay there until someone can pick him up in a bigger boat?" "That's right," Nico replied. "I spent the night there. The sea really had become too wild to risk it home. But since then, I've had a busy day. I've been talking to people in Marseille. We now see this could be a perfect solution for what to do with Jewish men who are trying to escape. Not with women, unfortunately. We are trying to find places for women and children in hilltop villages and out-of-the-way farms. But we can set up a system to take some men to the island, especially the most valuable men, professors and scientists." As Ellie went to say something, he added, "Obviously we can't save them all. That is the problem." Ellie nodded, trying to process this. "The abbot reckons a few men could stay there for quite a while without being detected. He says that since the Germans invaded, he's made sure that all his monks are never in the same place at the same time. Some working in the fields, others at chapel, others in their cell, so that it'd be hard to establish the number of monks on the island." "Oh, that's clever," she said. "And then, when we can, a boat will come for them and take them across to Corsica. Or if we can get a big enough boat, then over to Majorca, which is part of Spain. Either way, they'll be safer than here." She nodded, sensing he wanted to say more. "But I'm not sure about this next part, because it would put you in danger." "You want the men to come here?" "That would be ideal," he paused, looking directly at her. "If someone takes them from the city, directs them to a point on the other side of the hill, where they would be out of sight of the village, then we'll alert by radio. Maybe one of the men in your house can lead the Jewish man down to you. You put out the signal for me, and at night I'll come for him in the boat. But it would mean you'd be harboring the Jewish man until nightfall. Always a risk." "So far, they don't seem to know about us," Ellie said. "So far? Look, you can tell me now if you don't want any part of this. I understand." "Of course I want to help," she said. "Rounding up Jewish people like cattle, taking them off to God knows where, it's not human. And if I can help get a few of them to safety, then count me in." "I always knew you were a wonderful person," he said. "No, you didn't. You thought I was an annoying, spoiled Englishwoman," she laughed. "Well, I've changed my mind." "Look, Nico," she said, still considering this, "I can only agree for myself. It's possible the others will not want to put themselves in danger. You'd have to ask them. Are they already in bed?
They went up some time ago, Ellie said.
Then I'll come back in the morning and explain it to them, he said.
Ellie sensed he was about to leave.
You must be hungry and thirsty.
I've managed to grab a bite here and there, he replied.
But I wouldn't say no to a glass of wine if you still have any.
We have a few bottles still, she said.
Come through to the kitchen.
Nico paused, looking up the stairs.
That man you have staying here, the Viscount, is he safe, do you think?
Certainly not a fan of the Germans, she replied.
The officers have taken over his chateau and turned him out with only the clothes on his back. They also kept his servants and have helped themselves to his wine cellar. So no, I don't think he'd want to report us to them.
Good, but I think the less he knows about our little operation, the better.
That's all right, Ellie replied. The Viscount has no contact at all with the village. If he sees a strange man having a drink with us, we can tell him it's a neighbor who has come to visit.
Just watch what you say in front of him.
Yes, definitely.
Ellie took down a bottle of wine from the shelf and poured Nico a glass.
Then she put out bread and goat cheese. He ate and drank with relish.
That was just what I needed, he said, getting up to go.
Now what I need is a good night's sleep. I don't think I've had one in a while.
You're welcome to stay here, she said. You know I made up a bed for you.
Tempting.
His eyes held hers, but I feel responsible for my mother. She worries. I need to go home.
I'll be back in the morning.
Perhaps you could brief the Englishmen before I come, so they are not too surprised.
Yes, I'll do that. She walked with him to the front door.
Good night, then. Go carefully.
He paused. I have an absurd desire to kiss you, but that would not be wise.
Then I should not want to go home.
He blew her a kiss and hurried off, leaving her heart beating a little faster.
Ellie used the pretext of asking Tommy and Clive to help with the goats to get them out of the house.
Roland was still sitting at breakfast and did not volunteer to help.
When they were suitably far away, she told them the plan.
It's entirely up to you, she said. I don't want to put either of you at risk unless you fully agree to it.
Of course we must do it, Tommy said. We can't have human beings being rounded up and sent off to God knows what fate.
He looked at Clive. What do you think? I won't agree if you don't.
Ellie looked at Clive. He seemed less certain, but then he shrugged.
I've a personal vendetta against Germans since they lobbed a grenade at me in the last war, so I think we should do it.
He took a deep breath, as if not completely sure of what he was saying.
I've been trying to work on fake identity cards. It's proving not to be that easy, given the limited equipment I have. I suppose I can probably do a job that will pass scrutiny.
Cards that give races Aryan in case they are needed.
Oh, I'm sure they'll be needed, she said. The more you can make of those, the better.
But what about you, Clive said. This will be dangerous for all of us, including you, if they find out.
I know, but I think we have to do it.
Ellie stared out to the blue sea below them, wind-whipped with white-capped waves.
It can't be too many, just in case the Germans visit the island. So it won't put us in harm's way too often, I hope.
They looked up as they heard footsteps coming towards them. It was Nico.
I've told them, she said, and they agree.
Good men. Nico slapped Clive on the back.
Now let me fill you in on the details. Come with me. We'll decide on the path they will take and the meeting point.
The men went off with Nico.
Ellie returned to the house.
Where are your friends? Roland asked.
I'll put them to work mending part of the fence, she said. If the goat gets out, they'll eat all our plants.
He seemed to accept this.
I keep wondering if I should go back to Paris, he said. I'm good for nothing here except eating your food.
Oh, surely not Paris, Ellie replied. They don't have enough food, and the Germans are everywhere.
I'm sure I could arrange for food through the black market, he said.
Money is a useful commodity. I just feel so useless here.
It did occur to Ellie that it would be much easier for their future plans if he did go.
But how could you travel?
I do have my motor car.
You'd need enough petrol.
True, but I expect the black market might provide that.
And there will be checkpoints all along the way.
I shall tell them my aged mother is sick. I am returning as the dutiful son. I don't think they would stop me.
They could commandeer your car the way they took your house.
He considered this.
That's true. Maybe I should wait for the weather to improve. It may be hard to find cold for heating in Paris. Tommy and Clive returned much later, chatting and laughing as if they hadn't a care in the world. We went for a little stroll up the hillside, Tommy said. What a fine view there is from the top. But it's steep coming down. Clive sat on his bottom at one point. It's not polite to mention such an indignity, Clive replied. I shall go to my work room and work on my calligraphy. What have we got ourselves into, Ellie thought. We would be able to bluff our way through if the Germans find out. Chapter 40. The first of the men arrived 2 days later. He came, bundled in a great overcoat and scarf. It seemed he was wearing a jacket and jumper underneath, since he could not carry a suitcase with his clothing. Instead, he carried a small bag. He was sweating profusely, as much from fear, it seemed, as from the overabundance of clothing he was wearing. His eyes darted nervously as he looked around the room. "Don't worry," Ellie said. "You're safe here for the moment. We'll give the signal for your transport to pick you up tonight. In the meantime, you can take off your overcoat and sit down. I'll get you a glass of water." Most kind," he muttered. He had a deep, rumbling voice. He removed his hat and had a shock of gray, curly hair. "If anyone asks, you are a friend visiting us," Ellie muttered before she went through to the kitchen to pour the water. The man was sitting, perched on the edge of a chair, when she returned. Tommy had disappeared, and the man was staring out at the view below. "You have a lovely view here," he said. "Yes, it's a beautiful spot," Ellie handed him the glass. "I should introduce myself," he began, but she cut him off. "No, don't. The less we know about each other, the better, just in case." "You're right, just in case." He took a gulp of the water. "That was quite a walk, rather steep. I'm afraid I'm not incredibly fit." Then a spasm of pain crossed his face. "I still can't believe it," he said. "I never thought it would happen to me. I thought I was a respected member of the community. I'm the conductor of the Marseille Symphony Orchestra, you know. I've held the position for years. I have so many friends, so when they said all Jews have to report, I didn't think for a moment that I would be involved. But then one of my violists got a tip that they were coming for me. I left in the middle of a rehearsal." He shook his head as if he was still trying to make sense of it. "So many of my musicians are Jewish, too. How can they do this to us? We are valuable members of the community." His voice cracked, and he took another drink of water to swallow back the emotions. "I'm so sorry," Ellie said, "but with any luck, you'll be safe. The Italians are in control of Corsica, and they value music, don't they?" "Who knows anymore," he said. "The world has gone mad. We are all being ruled by a madman." "What about your wife?" Ellie asked, because she noticed the wedding band on his finger. "What will happen to her?" "She is not Jewish, thank God," he said, "but she has gone up to a friend in the countryside just in case they come to question her. Who knows if I'll ever see her again?" And a tear trickled down his cheek. He wiped it away hastily. Tommy returned and sat keeping him company, while Ellie went out to the terrace, and with hands that trembled a little, she pegged the blue shirt onto the line, raising it high enough to be seen. It fluttered bravely in the breeze. Would Nico see it, she wondered? How often did he check her line? Anyway, the man was safe for the moment. She fed him vegetable soup for lunch. Roland was delighted to find a guest and chatted to him about music. "How I have missed artistic company," he said. "I keep thinking I must go back to Paris, where I can attend the opera again." "Is the opera still performing, I wonder?" the man said. "I heard they have shut down so much, and of course there is the curfew after dark." "But the Germans love music," Roland said. "You would have thought so, wouldn't you?" the man replied. Ellie made a big show of inviting their guests to stay the night. Clive and Tommy went up to bed. Roland lingered. "At last," Ellie said pointedly, "you must be tired, my dear," to the man. "Let me show you to your room. You don't have to stay awake and be polite any longer." She led him upstairs. Roland also came up and went into his room. After a suitable while, Ellie tapped on the spare room door and led the man down again. "Get ready," she said. "We don't know when the boat will come, but I should take you down, just in case." She put on her overcoat, he put on his, and she led him out into the night. It was fortunate that the moon was almost full. She had brought a torch and picked out the steep and winding steps as they went down the hill. "Go very carefully," she said. They took the steps one by one. At the bottom, they came to the small harbor, a little dock protected by an outcropping of rocks. Any boat moored there would be invisible from passing ships. Ellie stood, listening and looking, every fiber in her being tense and alert. She heard the slap of waves against the rocks, the rustle of wind in the pine trees above. Apart from that, silence. "You should sit down here out of the wind," she said, indicating a flat area of rock. "It may be some time. He'll have to wait until he can slip away without being noticed. There are German sentries in the village now." The man brushed off the rock surface before sitting on it. "I don't know why you people risk your lives for someone you don't know," he said. "In my culture, you would be called a righteous person." "We have to do what we can," Ellie said. "We can't let evil swallow the world." "No, we can't." They sat in silence. Then Ellie stood up. "What was that?" She heard it then, the low pop-pop of a motor, and the boat came into sight. Nico flashed a signal from his torch, then cut the motor, and the boat drifted to them. He stood up, leapt out before it could hit the dock. "I picked up some oars," he said. "Better to row silently until I'm well clear of the village." He turned to the stranger. "Good evening, sir. A fine night for a sea voyage, I think." He helped the man into the boat, then pushed off, waved, and started the motor. Once they were out to sea, she heard it rev up to full power, and they were gone. In the morning, there was a note from Nico outside the front door. "All went smoothly. This is a great idea." Ellie herself was amazed how smoothly it had gone. More Jewish men followed. This concludes episode 10 of Mrs. Endicott's Splendid Adventure by Reese Bowen. Thanks so much for listening.